ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Monday, the 16th of March. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. A fifth member of the Iranian women's football team has withdrawn their claim of asylum and left the country overnight. Of the seven who chose to stay in Australia after the Asian Cup, only two now remain. The latest departure follows unverified claims that one of the women was passing on threats from the Iranian regime. Political reporter Isabel Rowe joined me earlier. So another woman has left Australia overnight. What can you tell us about the circumstances?
Yeah, look, this is a pretty difficult situation. We've got confirmation this morning from the Home Affairs Minister's office that a fifth woman has now left from the initial seven. Three left over the weekend, one last week. So that means there are only two of these women who remain. The Iranian diaspora, who have been helping these women while they're here, claim that they're in an incredibly tense and difficult situation. Almost all of the team, as we know, were offered asylum about a week ago now. Seven took it up, and they've been isolated in this safe house in Australia after they defected from Iran. But the campaigners who've been helping say that they believe that the team handler, who was one of those last women to join, was communicating propaganda from the Iranian regime to her teammates via text message. Now, government sources have told the ABC that they have looked into this. They don't have enough evidence to believe that that is true. However, the diaspora who's helping say clearly something has spooked these women. Now, the fifth woman who has left overnight, we believe, will return to Malaysia, where the rest of her team are, before they all go back together to Iran. And I guess there are concerns from those helping them here in Australia that even more of those women could change their mind.
So how has the Iranian regime reacted to these women changing their minds and deciding to return home?
Well, in the last 48 hours, some of the reporting that has come from the state news agencies has sort of claimed victory in this matter. They've talked about the national sweat and patriotism of the football team leading to the failure of the enemy's plans, the enemy being Australia and the US. They've talked about the women returning to the warm embrace of their families, and saying that Australia created a psychological warfare here and extensive propaganda and seductive offers. Now, the regime branded these women wartime traitors for not singing the national anthem while they were here. The women were doing this, we understand, as a show of defiance against that regime. And as a result, a lot of the women who've been helping them here say their families back in Iran have been threatened. There's reports that people have gone missing. And so essentially, there are concerns that the pressure has just gotten too much for the women here.
Isabel Rowe there. Israel and the United States' war with Iran is now stretching into its third week, with missile and drone attacks continuing to beset the Middle East. Now, the US Energy Secretary Chris Wright has admitted what has been patently clear: the Strait of Hormuz is not currently safe. Barbara Miller reports from Washington.
Chris Wright briefly gave energy markets false hope last week when a post on his account suggested the US Navy had already escorted a vessel through the Strait of Hormuz. The post was soon taken down, and on the Sunday talk shows, the energy secretary was careful not to artificially raise expectations. Here he is on NBC.
Is the Strait of Hormuz safe for shipping right now, Mr. Secretary?
No, it is not.
And on ABC America.
Can you guarantee it'll just be weeks before prices go down?
Hey, there's no guarantees in wars at all.
The energy secretary was appearing after a classic Donald Trump communication. The president said other nations would be sending warships to the Strait of Hormuz. In the same post, it was clear he was urging them to do so. Chris Wright said it's in everyone's best interests.
The world depends on the flows through Hormuz.
He said he expected friends and foes to come to the rescue.
We will continue a productive dialogue, and I do expect China will be a constructive partner in reopening the Straits of Hormuz.
The administration insists it anticipated the disruption to oil markets.
Then what was the plan? Was the plan to let them effectively close down, if they effectively closed down the Strait of Hormuz, which they have done, we would just see a spike in oil prices, hope that you can get Navy ships in there to escort oil tankers. Was that the plan?
We knew there'd be a temporary interruption of flows out of the Straits of Hormuz.
But its critics are not so sure. Former Transport Secretary Pete Buttigieg spoke to CNN.
Secretary Hegseth went so far as to say that the Strait of Hormuz is open, other than the fact that there would be fire against vehicles transiting the strait. This is clearly amateur hour at the Pentagon and in the White House.
For its part, Iran claims it's speaking to other countries about guaranteeing them safe passage through the strait. Here's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi on CBS.
We have been approached by a number of countries.
But the foreign minister rejects U.S. suggestions Iran is interested in ceasefire talks.
We don't see any reason why we should talk with Americans, because we were talking with them when they decided to attack us, and that was for the second time.
Donald Trump was on the golf course in Florida again today. He's expected back in the nation's capital later. This is Barbara Miller in Washington reporting for AM.
As fuel prices surge here at home, the federal government's offering reassurance that petrol and diesel supplies remain unchanged and there's no need for anyone to engage in panic buying. One Nation has been calling for fuel rationing to be introduced to shore up supplies for farmers, the road transport industry and the resources sector. But experts say localised shortages are being driven by fuel hoarding or stockpiling by industry in expectation that the cost of fuel will keep rising. Nick Grimm reports.
At a cut price independent service station on Sydney's busy Parramatta Road, Volkan Dogan has pulled in to fill his twin cab ute after arriving home from overseas at the weekend and finding things had changed during his absence.
Seeing the petrol price last night has actually really shocked me. There's a massive difference compared to before I left. So, yes, it actually shocked me. So there's a very big difference with the petrol price.
While fuel supplies might be little changed in metropolitan areas, some regional areas haven't been so lucky, with some providers forced to turn off their pumps as their tanks have emptied. It's led to calls for fuel rationing to be introduced in the big cities to ensure farmers and road transport companies aren't left high and dry. Dr. Amanda Kraft from Western Sydney University argues the shortages that have occurred are largely being driven by farmers, transport companies, miners and other operators of large machinery stockpiling fuel to get in ahead of further price increases.
So they're bringing forward their purchasing and they're accelerating their normal purchases, and they're even there would be some people who are hoarding, which involves stockpiling a commodity beyond what is normally required or likely to be needed or used by themselves.
That would suggest, wouldn't it, that the bloke filling a jerry can of petrol in the city isn't necessarily causing a shortage for broadacre farmers in regional areas, for example?
I suspect that it's largely what we're seeing is the occasional individual consumer with their jerry cans are reacting with panic to what they're seeing being purchased by larger corporate and agricultural producers.
And while panic buying can be difficult to control, as Senior Fellow for Energy and Climate Change at the Grattan Institute, Tony Wood, points out, the nation's overall consumption of fuel isn't going to change over the longer term.
We saw a spike in demand. So if a lot of people rushed out and filled their cars, for example, last week, that means they won't have to fill them this week.
Because I guess we've got to just remember at the end of the day, consumption actually hasn't increased, even if demand has.
Exactly right. That's a good way to put it. And it gets confusing. If some people have hoarded, I mean, there were some examples of people turning up with, you know, a ute full of jerry cans or something, that can cause a problem. But that's all going to go somewhere. People aren't just going to pour it down the drain.
The Albanese government has moved to free up additional petrol and diesel supplies by easing fuel standards to allow for the temporary sale in Australia of fuel containing higher sulphur levels, while also releasing hundreds of millions of litres of fuel from the nation's strategic reserves. The government has also tasked the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission with investigating price gouging concerns and to explore ways to improve fuel availability in regional areas.
Nick Grimm reporting. There have been mixed messages from the US President Donald Trump and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu about just how much longer the conflict will drag on. It's since boiled over on another front, with Israel reportedly preparing a ground invasion in southern Lebanon, targeting what it claims is a threat from the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah.
Early polling in Israel shows significant support for the war, and it's also showing a bump for Mr. Netanyahu in what will be an election year. Middle East correspondent Matthew Doran reports.
Warning sirens ring out across Tel Aviv, as they have done multiple times a day, as war with Iran has been raging. Iranian missiles fired in retaliation for Israeli and US strikes have been causing damage across the country, with cluster munitions making interception efforts far more challenging. But even with this hourly deadly threat, this war does have support from the public.
I'm very optimistic. I think that they're going to do a good job.
So I believe that this was inevitable.
As I say to all my friends, it just feels like another day in the Middle East.
And it's a threat the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been warning of for decades. Even amid criticism, his declarations of an imminent danger have been exaggerated or overblown. From 1996, in an address to the US Congress,
the most dangerous of these regimes is Iran.
To the UN General Assembly in 2012, armed with a cartoon diagram of a bomb.
Where should a red line be drawn? A red line should be drawn right here.
And a return visit to Congress in 2015.
The foremost sponsor of global terrorism could be weeks away from having enough enriched uranium for an entire arsenal of nuclear weapons.
Iran has certainly been his obsession, his part of his personal ideology as a political figure in Israel.
Dalia Scheindlin is one of Israel's most prominent political analysts.
Certainly, polls are showing since the war began that there is a majority, about 60%, who trust his handling of the war. But that is a very distinct question from whether people trust him as a leader.
Benjamin Netanyahu's reputation had taken a battering after Hamas's deadly attacks on Israel on October 7, 2023. That failure, his ongoing corruption trial, and an attempt to upend the judiciary, all chipping away at his popularity. But Dalia Scheindlin says conflict with Iran is a different situation.
Most countries will go through a rallying, we call the rally round the flag effect, where people will express strong social solidarity. It usually translates into high support for the government or trust in the government and the leader. But we also know that that typical rallying effect anywhere in the world fades over time.
Yes, Iran is a threat, but taking the Israeli population every 8 months for this kind of an ordeal, it's a problem.
Danny Citrinowitz is a former head of the Iran division of Israel's Defense Intelligence Establishment.
It's not a war of necessity, it's a war of choice, because the US and Israel thought that the regime is weak enough that we can do something dramatic against it together and change the future of the Middle East.
Benjamin Netanyahu has to head to the polls by October at the latest. When he'll call an election remains unclear, including whether he can capitalize on the popularity of this current conflict. But he'd be hoping some of the goodwill on the streets does linger. This is Matthew Doran in Tel Aviv, reporting for AM.
The South Australian algal bloom was only meant to last a few weeks, but a year on, dead fish and discoloured foam are still washing up on some of the state's beaches. A Four Corners investigation reveals how the state government was slow to update its health advice on the bloom, despite evidence suggesting the algae contained potentially harmful toxins. Angus Grigg reports.
At this intimidating surf break on South Australia's York Peninsula, the water is no longer pristine blue, but murky brown. Toxic foam washes up with every set. In January, this stretch of coastline near Corny Point was hit for a second time in a year by this unprecedented algal bloom.
As it moves through, it's killing things incredibly fast. The same happened last year during the bloom, but I think the intensity's just stepped up.
Lockie Cameron manages the Corny Point Caravan Park, and like others in the community, thought the worst was over.
This bloom seemingly came out of nowhere. Everyone in this community is suffering from it.
While Adelaide's beaches are now mostly algae-free, the bloom has moved further north along the western side of York Peninsula.
The reality of the algal bloom sometimes isn't nearly as bad as people's perception of it.
Premier Peter Malinauskas's tendency to downplay the bloom's severity has led to accusations the state government was too slow in changing its health advice. A Four Corners investigation has found the SA government took months to update the advice for asthmatics, despite the discovery of a potentially harmful compound known as brevetoxin.
It's also extremely rare anywhere in the world, so just our detection of brevetoxins is a trigger for full investigation.
Professor Shauna Murray is an expert on algal blooms from UTS and says the public should have been told sooner about the discovery of brevetoxin.
It can cause respiratory difficulties, including asthma, pneumonia, breathing difficulties potentially. So a potentially serious human health impact.
Despite brevetoxins being detected in oysters, a shark that washed up dead, and in two kangaroos, the SA government took 4 months to change its health advice.
The initial advice was too optimistic.
Fran Boehm is a professor of public health at Adelaide University.
Overall, there was a real desire to downplay the impact. And I think that's because they were concerned about the impact on tourism, would stop people coming to South Australia, the impact on the fishing industry and so on.
The government says it initially thought the dominant algal species did not produce brevetoxins. It says the health advice was updated after the toxin was discovered in seafoam. As Australia feels the effects of climate change, experts warn that unforeseen environmental events, like the SA algal bloom, will become increasingly common.
We've got an ecosystem collapsing here. Yes, it's sad, but it's much more than sad because it's actually the kind of life system that we all depend on.
Professor Fran Boehm there from Adelaide University, ending Angus Griggs' report. And you can catch the Four Corners episode tonight on ABC TV at 8:30 or at any time on iView. South Australians are just days out from their state election, and with pundits predicting Peter Malinauskas will be returned as Premier, another story is emerging. One Nation. The SA poll is considered the first electoral test for the party since its surge in popularity. So can it translate that support into seats? Political reporter Evelyn Manfield reports from South Australia's York Peninsula.
On the main street of Maitland in South Australia, 160 kilometres west of Adelaide, dozens of locals are at the pub. It's happy hour, but that's not why they're here. It's to meet One Nation leader Pauline Hanson. The general sentiment from supporters is they're fed up.
Rural Australia, most importantly, have had a gutsful of this no-action political leadership. And I believe that One Nation have got that. They've got the runs on the board to prove that they can actually make a difference.
Among supporters, Senator Hanson's history of race-based politics or her lead candidate, Corey Bernardi, standing by 2012 comments linking same-sex marriage to bestiality, isn't top of mind.
Buying houses, getting out of reach for someone our age, especially with a child.
Why do you think One Nation will be the party to be able to make that difference?
I just think that Pauline's very authentic.
Pauline Hanson says her party can help.
Where are the services that people need? You've got to drive to Adelaide to get your services. Everything is falling. It's failing because of governments.
One Nation's only ever won one seat in SA's parliament 4 years ago. That was Sarah Game, and she's since defected.
I'm concerned about seeing, a number of One Nation people elected to parliament. I think, if you have, one voice or something like that, I think that's, minimal damage. But I think to see, a number of people elected would be a shame.
The party's hopeful this time round is ex-Liberal Senator Corey Bernardi. How the party goes on Saturday is their first electoral test since rising popularity in opinion polls.
My measure of success is a voice in the parliament, the more the merrier. But we can still do very, very well and poll very highly. But if the Uni Party decide they don't want One Nation representatives there and they direct their people to preference against us, that can work against us too.
Some political pundits think One Nation's polling won't materialise into big wins, but the major parties aren't taking chances.
If you look for One Nation's health policy, you'll find nothing. Housing policy, virtually nothing. Economic policy, not anything. Just a lot of videos complaining about culture war issues.
That's Labor Premier Peter Malinauskas. In the race for Premier, Liberal leader Ashton Hearn knows she's the underdog, having only been in the top job for 100 days. And after leadership changes both locally and in Canberra, she's conscious some voters are looking elsewhere.
I think people are looking to One Nation because they're annoyed that major parties haven't got the important things right. But that's why I'm laser focused on getting the basics right.
Liberal leader Ashton Hearn, ending that report by Evelyn Manfield. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was one of the worst environmental disasters in Australia's history. When a massive algal bloom arrived in South Australia, the public was initially told it wasn't toxic, when the government had been told it was. Today, Four Corners reporter Angus Grigg on his investigation into why the health impacts were downplayed. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.